Europe is complicated. Has anyone noticed the UK still doesn't have a government? Previously in Europe, Romania's Prime Minister. And now we're turning over to kind of a election section, what's happening in various governments section.
Yes.
Because, yeah, like we mentioned last episode, there was French legislative elections. Mm-hmm. They happened when we were recording. And now we can talk about the results to a certain extent.
Yes.
Yeah, so I'll give you the breakdown. The Republic on the Move, as this has been translated here on the English version of France 24, which feels weird to me. I'm way more happier saying Republic on March.
Yeah.
But, yeah, Republic on the Move sounds like a cool funk band, though.
Do you want to start a funk band called Republic on the Move?
No, let's start a revolutionary reggae band.
No.
Anyway. Republic on March got about 43% of the vote, which resulted in a 308-seat majority for their party. So, yeah, this is kind of what polls predicted, that this was going to go well for Macron. So, mm-hmm. Hooray! Other things of note is that the next biggest party is Les Républicains, who have 112 seats.
Yep.
The Socialist Party was pretty much decimated. They got 30 seats. And the National Front, despite a reasonably high percentage of votes, didn't do well in the second round, like a lot of people predicted.
Yeah, well, they suffer from kind of a similar problem that UKIP suffer from, and a lot of other parties of like on the far end of any of a particular of either spectrum. It's one spectrum on the far end of, both far ends of the spectrum.
Right.
That they tend to run candidates everywhere, and they're only actually sufficiently popular in a couple of places, or have strong candidates in a couple of places. So, like, they end up with, like, the National Front have ended up with 8 seats out of a 8.7% vote, which is, like, not, like, that's a small number of seats for how much vote they got, but they were running in an awful lot of seats, and an awful lot of seats they got to the second round with no chance of winning.
Yeah, it's kind of this, it's a mini version, since they're all basically mini presidential elections, this is how they're, the two rounds, the exact same thing happens that usually happens when National Front gets to the second round of a presidential vote.
Yeah.
Everyone votes against them.
Yeah,
to kind of put it in perspective, the 8.75% they got resulting in 8 seats, when you compare that to the 1.2% of the vote the Communist Party got, mm-hmm. but they ended up with 10 seats. And this is probably because they ran better campaigns at a more local level rather than crazy national far-reaching thing.
Yeah.
I also get the impression National Front suffers from another similar issue that UKIP suffers from, which is a bit of a cult of personality based around the leaders, mm-hmm. while a lot of the individual politicians they run are not very appealing.
Yeah, they often tend to have, like, reasonably weak candidates in constituencies where they don't actually have a large party presence or party membership, but it's very much whoever they run will get a certain percentage of the vote, like, off the coattails of the national persona, but that doesn't really work in a more local orientated election.
I mean, the only thing that I'm not entirely certain if France does this, but I know Ireland does this, the UK kind of does this to a certain extent. If you get a certain percentage of the vote, it unlocks, like, funding and stuff like that.
Yes,
that you can
receive
from the state. So their gravy train is still kind of going.
I guess kind of anecdotally, another thing to mention about is that the abstention rate in France, or, like, the kind of, like, actual turnout is incredibly low, especially in the second round, and this year, like, more so than other years, like, it's generally pretty high, but the abstention rate in the second round overall was nearing 50% more.
Let me see turnout rate. Yeah, I remember correctly that like at 5 o'clock on voting day, it wasn't particularly high, especially when compared to the last election, the 2012 election. Yeah, this is kind of a story a lot of people are running with. The turnout on Sunday, here we go, was 42.64%.
Yeah, which is kind of like, that's like artificially low due to the French, like to the two votes really close together system, and also like that they just had the presidential election where the turnout was higher, but like not, turnout generally isn't great. There's like a large amount of voter apathy and the French election. It's very much of a I don't expect anything to change either way kind of attitude.
Also, to kind of to add to that, this is kind of interesting. So 42.6% of voters turned out. 38.43% of voters cast a valid ballot.
Yeah, right.
That's a pretty, that's a 4% difference.
Yeah.
That's pretty big of like spoiled ballots.
Yeah. There's an awful lot, like as in the percent, like looking at some individual constituencies, you kind of get like 5-6% percentages of people submitting blank ballots. So they just go get their ballot and submit it blank as like a protest. Right. Or people who spoil their ballots also tends to be around like over 2%, kind of that kind of region. Yeah, just looking at some random constituencies, I'm seeing like there's one constituency like I randomly picked that had a 13% blank ballot rate, which is like not, you know, that's kind of indicative of people kind of saying like, I don't think either of these candidates are good. I don't expect anything to change. Interesting enough, like there's kind of the you'd need a lot of transfer of those people to parties like the National Front for them to get like actual big footing in the parliament. Their voter percentage, like they would need a large bump to turn their 8% into like an equivalent number of seats because they're spread so thin in this system. Anyway,
this is kind of the story a lot of people are running with. The EU Observer had as their headline after the election, France gives Macron big majority with little enthusiasm.
That's a very good description of what's happened. And that like Macron is a substantial majority, but you know,
and he himself seems to be like, I don't think, because this isn't a prime ministerial system.
No,
I don't think you can translate low turnout with dissatisfaction with Macron himself. I haven't taken a look at any kind of opinion polls of him, but I haven't been hearing anything that he's disliked.
That's the thing. If there was an act of disapproval of Macron, people would have turned out to vote against him.
Yeah, that's actually a way better way of putting it. Yeah.
Which is the same of like saying like the National Front got 8% of the vote. It's like, yeah, but 8% of the incredibly low turnout. That's like, that's actually not that's a substantial number of people, but it's not like 8% of the French population or even like eligible voting population thinks they're a good idea. If like with their like very hard line positions, if you agreed with them at all, you'd probably be very likely to turn out and vote for them. So
right,
yeah, there's like there's a funny thing. A lot of the polling was showing that Macron was heading to a big win. So kind of, unless you're passionate about his very, very centrist views on a lot of stuff.
Very pragmatic.
It's a hard thing to get people enthused about, of just like, we're going to do the most pragmatic, you know, sensible solution to this.
We're not going to do anything radical.
Yeah, regardless of your feelings, we're going to look at some data. It's like, that's nice.
that seems responsible.
Yeah, there's from talking to some French people, I know a great answer I heard when asked like, oh, what do you think Macron's gonna do, was just like, well, he says he'll do everything. Every time he's asked anything, he disagrees with it. And it's like, that seems like a good idea. I'll look into it. So like, he doesn't seem to give, it's not that he gives like political answers trying to dodge the question. He just says like, that seems reasonable. I'll look into it and maybe do it, to basically everything anyone suggests. So he's very much like pliable, I guess, is perhaps the way of looking at it.
Right.
In that he doesn't know where he stands on a lot of stuff. So it's very hard to kind of sell people on voting for him if you're like, what are you getting? Well, you're getting Macron, we'll look at it later and make a decision.
yeah, I also want to talk about just quickly that in France with their legislative elections, since there are a bunch of mini presidential elections, if you win over 50% of the vote in your seat,
yeah,
then there's no second round for your seat and you're automatically in.
Yep.
That happened only with four people.
Yep.
Two candidates from the Republic en Marche, one Les Républicains,
mm-hmm.
and one guy from a party called the Radical Party of the Left.
It's a good name.
It's a good name, which I find interesting because this chart I'm looking at has sort of the parties by where they stand on the political spectrum. Mm-hmm. And I can see there are further, more radical parties on the left. It would seem.
You think you get what you pay for with the naming of political parties, but apparently not.
No. But yeah, that was the election. Pretty much by the books, by how people predicted it was going to go.
Yeah.
But I think the turnout would be something that maybe some opposition will use against Republic en Marche to be like, oh, no one really wants you or something.
Yeah.
We'll see how it goes.
But this is the same problem of the argument of, you need to have like a good opposition. So like we could, in theory, like pull together enough votes to oust a government. And it's like, well, has that ever happened? It's like, well, the last time it happened was in the 30s or something. It's like, once you start looking at this stuff, it's kind of like, like that argument is, oh, but the turnout was so low. Like, do people really want you? It's like, yeah, but you ran an election as well, and the turnout was incredibly low, and you got even less seats.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be interested to find out why the turnout was so low, or if they have done like
a poll. This isn't that far off the previous year or previous elections.
No, it's not, I suppose.
Turnout in French parliamentary election tends to be quite low.
Is it probably? I'm just kind of curious because if it was people saying like, Republic en Marche have it in the bag.
Yeah, I'd say that probably didn't help.
Yeah, like they probably just kind of became a bit apathetic about it. But sure, that's France.
Mm. And now moving on to Romania, for a reasonably brief look at a ongoing political turmoil there. Effectively, what happened was, we talked about Romania in the past, and there was the mass protests regarding the government trying to roll back anti-corruption legislation, because the argument of the protesters was this would basically cause a lot of people affiliated with their party in the past to be released from prison on corruption, that they're in on corruption charges. And the government's argument was that they needed to free up prison space because the prisons were overpopulated. So it does kind of sound like you're just trying to get your political allies released from prison, where they're there for, like, you know, unduly forwarding your political aims. There's the funny situation of the previous, now ex-Romanian Prime Minister, Soren Grindeau. I'm sure I'm pronouncing that not even close. So he lost his job during the week because they had a no-confidence vote against him. This was because he refused to resign after his party, the Social Democrats, the PSD, and their junior partner, the ALDE, pulled their political support from government, like the parties did officially. Which you might think is an unusual situation, because in a lot of systems that have a prime minister, the prime minister tends to also be the head of the party. Not in this case, because the actual head of the PSD, Liviu Dragnea, again, probably not close. He is leader of the party. However, he's ineligible to be prime minister because he had a suspended jail sentence for being convicted of trying to rig a referendum in 2012. Which I think, you know, if your party is embroiled in accusations of not legally trying to roll back anti-corruption legislation, it's like, well, we don't need all this anti-corruption legislation. It's like, well, the leader of your party has been convicted of corruption, trying to rig election. Anyway,
yeah, I'm very curious on, because I don't know how popular he is as a person, Dragnea.
Yeah,
the actual leader of the party, because yeah, I'm so suspicious whether he's just really, really charismatic and really, really popular with the voter base. Mm. Because it really seems like that would be a record that would like tarnish you out of the job. Maybe you could still be like an MP, like a representative
in your, yeah, in a very local area. Well, it's kind of thing, like, is that like the PSD don't have an outright majority, like as in they, like, no. they're in a coalition, but it's
with
like,
ALDE, yeah.
Yeah, and the generally what I gathered from when we looked at this more, when we looked at the breakdown of Romania's politics more closely during the protests, was that like there's large chunks of people in the cities that are very aware of this is a problem, and that like Romania is seen as a corrupt country in a lot mm-hmm. of ways by like the EU, who they need, like they're gave the money for infrastructure projects from, etc. And yeah, they want like closer ties with the EU, and like if there was ever a discussion of moving to the euro, it's difficult to do with like corruption baggage. Yeah. And the ruling party trying to roll that back is a problem for them. Like the people who, it's more closely visible how the EU benefits them. However, like rurally, the PSD was quite strong, and kind of has its voter base who turn out for elections, meaning yeah, they were big enough to be the like main partners in the coalition. But yeah, so effectively the now previous prime minister refused to resign, saying this was like Dragnea trying to have a power grab and replace him with someone more loyal to him. So he was effectively going to be prime minister by being prime minister.
Right.
But yeah, a no confidence vote passed. Like it was supposed to, like it's a secret ballot, but the PSD asked its MPs to disclose that they voted, which showed up that almost all of them voted against the current prime minister. So it's basically all the PSD and, you know, opposition parties aren't going, like are unlikely to vote, like to not vote to oust the sitting government if they're opposed to them. So like it passed, it was like a not like super not close vote, but they got 241 votes. They needed 233. So it's a reasonable thing.
It's yeah, bad.
Romania, so they need to have negotiations for a new new government on Monday. But yeah, Romania is in kind of flux.
Be interesting to see if that coalition forms up again.
Yeah, well, that's kind of the close thing to watch at. Because, like, again, like this would be closely watching Romania for people who were active during the during the protests, because kind of the argument put forward for replacing the prime minister was that he wasn't doing his reforms as quickly as they said they would in their manifestos. Like the coalition promises weren't being met. From what I could gather, those corruption rollbacks were part of their promises. So if that happens again, who knows? Great, and now back, unfortunately, to the UK for, I don't know how many weeks running this is, but back to the UK again. Because we had that stupid election, then the election's done, and now Brexit negotiations have technically started, I guess, sort of. But I imagine that'll be like a bubbling in the background thing for a long time. But there's a few like salient, relevant to Europe pieces of legislation. The main bit of which is that like, while there technically is a government in the UK, like really there isn't, because there's no agreement that the Conservatives have, or like assurance that they have in any form, that if there was a no confidence vote tomorrow, that the government would survive. Because effectively, so they're still in negotiations with the DUP, the Democratic Unionist Party from Northern Ireland, who they need their 10 seats to reach a actual voting majority that would assure they wouldn't be like they couldn't be voted out without some like votes from within their party. However, the negotiations haven't gone as smoothly as they expected them to go. I think effectively the expectation from the current government was that the DUP would kind of agree to do this with very little questions asked, but it turns out the DUP have demands and or kind of feel like they aren't being respected properly in these like good faith negotiations. It's more kind of a based on like talk from conservative MPs giving interviews and whatnot, it's who aren't on the inside of the government in the cabinet, is that like Theresa May, the prime minister, tends to be quite closed off and has her inner, her reasonably small inner circle. And it wouldn't surprise me if they're quite aggressive and not very good negotiators. If you have the DUP, who are like more conservative than the Conservative Party, disagreeing with them on things. And I feel like a lot of it's possibly down to bad communication. Of the DUP asked for something, they're told no outright without any discussion on it, as opposed to how you'd actually conduct a negotiation.
Yeah, it's slightly concerning that this kind of like closed off Theresa May is still happening, because I feel like that was a complaint of the previous Theresa May government, I guess, if this is the second one.
Yes.
Because like, wasn't there stories that people didn't find out about the snap election like until they saw it on TV?
So there was there was that, and then there was people in the cabinet said that they found out about it in the cabinet meeting where she was announcing that she was about to announce it publicly.
Oh god!
So kind of like, as you were like, you thought you were on the inside being a minister, and then suddenly they were like, "By the way, we're having an election. You better prepare."
I wonder how a coalition partner might feel about this kind of structure.
Yeah, well, this is the thing. They're not doing it as an official coalition, which is like for the best. But you know, in a lot of ways, it's making it difficult to. I think the people on the inside were making it not an official coalition, so they wouldn't have to give a lot away. Whereas, in actual fact, they couldn't do it because it would be legally problematic and politically a nightmare. But my impression of how the negotiations have gone is they were saying it's not an official coalition, possibly before, so they wouldn't have to give many concessions.
Yeah, like the perception, the rest of the UK is now getting very aware of what the DUP is. And even if they take out the constitutional crisis question, which I'd imagine a lot of people in England aren't even really thinking about, a lot of people in Wales, a lot of people in Scotland, etc., etc. But they're not. The optics of the DUP are not great in the rest of the UK now that people know what they are. I particularly liked Frankie Boyle's comment on it, the DUP, the political wing of the Old Testament.
That was so, like, yeah.
So people are concerned, and then like speaking of some Scottish stuff here, Ruth Davidson is getting absolutely hammered over the fact that like there might be a Conservative DUP deal because she is lesbian herself. She has a wife and. Or long-term partner, I'm not entirely certain. But, like, people keep questioning her how can she support a party that is very, very openly homophobic?
Yeah, so, like, there was a cross-party push to have some, like, have progressive social things added to the Queen's speech as an amendment, for instance, which got, like, some conservative votes, because there are, like, lots of people in the Conservative Party who are socially liberal, but are members of the Conservative Party for, like, their, like...
For economic reasons.
Exactly, for economic reasons, but, like, wouldn't subscribe to the DUP style of conservatism, where it's largely social, and they don't, because of the demographics of Northern Ireland, would be very anti-austerity, for instance, because it, like... would negatively impact the somewhat older population of the...
Their
voter base to begin with, but also Northern Ireland in general.
So I guess you have your, like, I guess what Americans would call the libertarian wing of the Conservatives. But then, that is an interesting point, actually, because I kind of forgot about the economic positions of the DUP. They're probably the opposite of that libertarian wing. Very much so, socially conservative, but more economically, possibly in favor of more of Jeremy Corbyn's kind of economic plans.
Yeah, well, even though they wouldn't admit it. Definitely some of them, but they would argue like pro businessy way. Anyway, so this is kind of still boiling over. We'll see if anything, like, as in what when an actual like official deal is announced of any sort. People generally are now expecting it to be like the quotes from DUP members now is like, oh, there's a 90% chance of a deal going forward. It's probably pretty likely. It's probably going to be additional infrastructure funding and money for Northern Irish health services and stuff promised. In effect, like isn't it? It'll probably be extra funding that only benefits Northern Ireland. Like, it'll be specific stuff the DUP want that isn't you know, politically compromising to the Conservatives. But I imagine the reason it's taken so long behind the scenes has probably because the DUP were trying to see what other things they could get out of it. Like, for instance, like the there was a High Court decision a couple of days ago, which was about whether or not people in Northern Ireland if Northern Irish citizens would have to pay for abortions in the UK, because they can't get them in Northern Ireland at all. But whether or not they could travel and get them for free elsewhere in the UK, or like on the NHS. And the answer to that was no, that they're not entitled to it in the courts, because like their local health services isn't paying for it, so they shouldn't be like go anywhere else and get it, like would be true if any other local services are provided. But the getting something like that enshrined in law, that would make it very that it wouldn't have to go to the High Court to get decided, would be something the DUP would quite like, probably. But it would be a political disaster.
Scotland has said they're going to grant women from Northern Ireland free abortions.
Yeah, well, you know, there's
which is great, because the DUP hate the SNP.
They do. Yeah, they're not not buddies. Yeah.
Nope.
Anyway, so yeah, there technically is a minority government, but like, is there a minority government? They haven't made any agreements yet. There's like an interesting thing of and also bubblings in the background of people in the Conservative Party who don't like Theresa May to begin with, trying to look for potential leadership challenges. There is a thinking that when they have their party conference in the autumn, that they'll just elect a new leader then, and they won't make a big fuss of it, and possibly like behind the scenes discussing that as an option to be like, don't host like mount a big challenge now, we'll just sort it out and like in Cameron times.
Don't make a spectacle of it.
Yeah, because anything that like jeopardizes the DUP deal, for instance, would potentially trigger another election, because if they couldn't win a no confidence vote, then that'll just probably be what happens.
So like, I have like just two kind of things to say about that. I feel like this, how you said is there a minority government kind of thing, it's that whole kind of like Wile E. Coyote, he runs out over a cliff and doesn't realize he's over nothing until he actually looks down. Kind of thing. Was like, yeah, there's a minority government until they try to pass something, and then we'll see how actually there is a minority government. Like,
yeah, well, that's it exactly. And that, like, the Queen's Speech is a good example of they can put forward like what was like a very, very tempered, quite like reasonably legislatively empty Queen's Speech, like missing a bunch of the stuff that would have like were in the Conservative Manifesto, for instance. However, then you get like a cross-party amendment to it enshrining abortion rights and stuff to make a point about the DUP negotiations of like, don't even try and put anything like this in it because there's cross-party support to oppose it. And kind of like the entire argument of their election was we're like a stable choice, how it's very difficult to see if they will be able to work out an actual working arrangement, because like the coalition of opinions they have to put together is problematic. I guess the other thing to talk about is that Theresa May was in Brussels during the week to kick off Brexit negotiations and various discussions in that matter. It hasn't gone well.
Has not gone well.
The big incident being that so they're announcing next week what their like initial offer for EU residents currently in the UK to have for like ongoing residency. Their description of it has always been, it's a big and generous offer. We're trying to be like good faith upfront, offering something that seems like that you could like potentially disagree with immediately. However, the way Theresa May announced this to like the people in Brussels was, we're not going to break up families, which is like really unusual phrasing and doesn't make it sound good at all, which makes it sound like we're gonna, like, that's something they're going to look into. They're going to look into whether or not we'd be breaking up a family by deporting you.
We're going to do, yeah, it's kind of a great, it's too much to like say, where it's like, you know, you're meeting up for an online date and like the first message you get from the guy is just like, well, I'm not going to murder you.
Yeah.
Kind of like, this really wasn't on the table until you mentioned it.
Yeah. I didn't want to have this conversation, but I guess we are, which effectively was like everyone who was present for this. I think it was at a dinner or like at a big round table discussion.
EU summit was happening over the weekend, and Theresa May is privy to some of it.
Yes,
like she's invited to some events, and then there's other events she isn't.
Yeah, so this was effectively taken as a, why are we just like, has it come to that? Was that ever something we were discussing? We were all under the assumption that we'd work out some sort of agreement that potentially like people would get like a period of time would be the worst case scenario. Like breaking up families makes it sound like potentially on the table is like immediate deportations, which is not something like, everyone was considering.
Isn't that like human rights violation to break up families like that, like forcefully or something? I can't remember.
Yeah, well,
I feel like that's
based on this is a funny thing of a few commentators like who are kind of in the Brussels bubble have said is that they like the main thing they never understood about the whole Brexit thing is that Brussels is viewed in like large parts of the UK as being like incredibly bureaucratic and like nonsense filled, whereas that's like the predominant opinion in Brussels of how the UK government operates. The main example they have is the sticking point they will have, no matter how generous Theresa May's offer is that they don't want the rights of EU citizens in the UK to be dictated like by the Home Office in the UK, because the Home Office has a very bad track record at dealing with like the UK's record recently on refugees isn't good in terms of like processing time, like administrative fuck ups, like generally like weird bureaucracy being added. There's like a running joke of this like enormous checklist they have for immigrants that is like far more detailed than any other country in the EU, and like not in a sensible way, and it kind of, you seem to have just, because of people's concern about immigration, you seem to have just made it more difficult for people to emigrate there, as opposed to making it actually more selective. You just added more red tape. So like they want the European Courts of Justice to have like final say to be like, okay, well we've all agreed this is the rule. The Home Office in the UK can't like adjudicate disagreements because we've agreed on something and we want to be able to be the final arbiters on it because we don't trust you to do it.
I guess also the other concern would be that if this is left into the hands of like UK government process, then 5 or so years down the line after they've left the EU, what's to say they'll stop?
Yeah, exactly. That's like, the I think like it's effectively a guarantee on they see the whims of like changing processes in UK immigration law and like operation on a like year to year basis to be sufficiently high that they want some sort of other guarantee in place for any like for any agreement. Rumors of what's on the table at the moment would be Any UK citizen who has happened to live in the UK for more than 5 years can apply for residency, even if they like as they would be able to previously. They're going to count any 5 years they've lived, and then anyone who's was here before the date, like some agreed cutoff date, would get a visa for the time to bring them up to the 5 years, so then they could then apply for residency, but they would have to complete the 5 years, if you get me.
Yeah.
So like that, like those are two perfectly that's perfectly reasonable. But you can see the EU side of it. Of yeah, but how do we like, we don't trust the Home Office to deal with refugees because they don't in a lot of the time. So
yeah,
how do we trust them to actually there has generally been a problem in the past of people applying for residency and the Home Office being very difficult about accepting like proof of residency for time periods, that being notoriously difficult in the UK, like more so than in other countries. So it's kind of like you can say up front, okay, anyone who's been here for 5 years, but our version of 5 years, and it's kind of there's not like a lot of trust about UK immigration function in Brussels. So Theresa May's wording of we're not going to break up any families makes it sound like what we're saying up front isn't as good as it sounds.
you gotta lead with the worst case scenario. Get everyone just thinking negatively. That's negotiations.
Yeah, generally, like the consensus seems to be that Theresa May isn't good at negotiations in general, which is problematic if you know she wants to be prime minister during a long-term negotiation.
She is the prime minister of negotiations. This is what the future of UK politics is going to be for a while, is negotiations.
UK politics and this podcast.
Yeah.
Previously in negotiations, that's what we can call it.
Previously in May's head.
Cornfields.
Just what flashes of like Donald Tusk looking disappointed.
I'm not sure how we could do an audio podcast on that, but I'm willing to give it a try. Previously in Europe is produced by Kieran Dold and Hugh O'Brien. If you like this podcast, why not tell a friend? Or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, that really helps. Or wherever you download your podcast might have a review function, that would also be cool. You can get in contact with us. We're at Prev in Europe on Twitter, and you can email us. We're previouslyineurope@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.